Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on billions for the bankers, debts for the people, right after this. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps as a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Well, listen to James Nielsen. Now, Nielsen is a professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's a law school professor when he said this, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." He said it's worse than that. Most of the students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. If you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and just send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, back in the late 1970s, Sheldon Emery, he used to operate an outfit called the Lord's Covenant Church, America's Promise Broadcast, out in Phoenix, Arizona. He wrote a little book called Billions for the Bankers and Debts for the People. I think he probably wrote it for his own church and his own parishioners, but he circulated it nationwide, and it's a thumbnail introduction to this thing of money and money power and banking. You've probably heard me say from time to time that I don't have a checking account. I don't have a bank account. I don't do business in Federal Reserve notes. I use gold and silver coin. Sounds kind of crazy. You know, 100 years ago, your great-granddad didn't deal with the banks, didn't have a checking account, didn't have a savings account, and he did his business in gold and silver. And he had plenty of money. And your great-great-grandma didn't work outside the home. Today, 80% of America's women are working. That's right. 80% of America's women are out here working in the marketplace trying to make ends meet. Well, some of them, I guess, want a career. But when I was a kid, for a woman to work outside the home was proof positive that the husband in that home was incompetent, unable to support his family. It was a shame for a woman to be working out in the marketplace. That didn't mean that there weren't some women working out in the marketplace back in 1900 or 1910, 20 or 30, but not very many. most men could support their families, and they did. Well, billions for the bankers and debts for the people tells us why it is that 80% of America's women are out in the marketplace working. They have to make ends meet, to pay all the interest that you pay for the big screen TV and the automobiles. And people today will say, well, we've got the highest standard of living in the world. Well, that may be true. I suppose if you took all of your savings and all of your retirement and you spent it over the next 5 years, your living standards would go up, wouldn't they? Americans have been borrowing themselves into a pit for about 70 years now, and it looks like to me that the borrowing and the orgy is just about over. We're coming to an end here. As my old granddaddy used to tell me, he said, it's time for you to come down to earth. As he'd grab me and shake me until my teeth rattled, you know, when they get a little out of line, you know. Kids do that. Well, societies and empires do the same thing. The Roman Empire got a little out of control and finally went out of business. The Egyptians, same thing. Babylonians, Greeks. You know, you look around the world, the Mayas and the Aztecs and all of these great civilizations and empires, they've all crumbled and collapsed. The American Empire isn't any different than the Roman Empire or the Egyptian Empire or the Babylonian, Assyrian, or Greek or Sparta or Athens or Aztecs or anybody else. And there are certain cause and effect relationships that we all ought to be aware of, and banking is one of those cause and effect relationships. Listen to Thomas Jefferson. He was our third president. He's the guy that penned the Declaration of Independence. Maybe all the ideas weren't his. He probably had a little collaboration there, but he's the guy that penned it. He's the guy that sat down and wrote it out. Pretty knowledgeable guy about the Declaration of Independence, about the Constitution, third president of the United States. He had a plantation, owned two or three slaves, and he had an observation concerning banks and bankers. Did you know that? Good old Tom Jefferson had some thoughts on banking. He said, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their money, first by inflation and then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of their property until their children will wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. Thomas Jefferson. Yeah, I'd say that's about correct. That's been my observation. Now, I didn't know anything when I was born back in 1939. I didn't know very much. So everything that I know today, I had to learn between 1939 and today. I was born at the end of the Great Depression. And, of course, that was on the minds of everybody when I was growing up. The Great Depression, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and all of the agencies that grew up around him, and this concept, you know, of taking our gold in 1933, and then Lyndon Johnson took our silver in 1965. You know, I was raised in an era when we had gold and silver coin, or when it wasn't that far removed from reality. My Uncle Lyle was preaching me a sermon one time. I was about 11, 12, 13 years old. See, he was born in 1899, my Uncle Lyle was, and of course he knew about gold and silver coin. Think of it now, by 1933, see, he's in his early 30s, and here comes Franklin Roosevelt and takes our gold away. Well, he knew something was wrong there. He knew something wasn't quite right. Now, the average American today, you know, born in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, he not only doesn't know what gold is, he hasn't got a clue as to why an archaic old coin called gold would be important in economics. What the connecting link might be between gold and silver and the demise of the Roman Empire or the Babylonians or the Aztecs or anybody else. He hadn't got a clue. All he knows is that he takes a $5 bill and puts it on the counter in Walmart and walks out with the goods. And what does he care whether he paid for it with gold or silver coin? And what does he care about the founding fathers in Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution that says no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt? He couldn't care less. Now, that's the average guy. And most people don't care much about Thomas Jefferson's observations about banks and banking. I mean, after all, when you want a car, you go down to the bank and borrow the money and go buy the car. You go into the car dealer and you sign all the appropriate papers, and he says, well, that's going to cost you $500 or $800 a month, and you make those payments and you drive out with that new car. Now, that's what you had in mind when you walked in there, and that's what you received when you walked out. Now, oftentimes, people will sign a contract, and then they'll make their payments, and they find out that they haven't got enough money to pay the rent and the car payments, and to pay the other bills, you know, on the other consumer items, and buy food and clothes, and do all those things that people want to do, and then it causes a lot of friction, and divorce comes out of that. Now, the Bible has something to say about money. The love of money is the root of all evil, it says in 1 Timothy 6, verse 10. And there's a couple of other scriptures, you know, that say a little something about money. If you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, you shall not be to him as a usurer, and neither shall you lay upon him usury. Exodus 22, verse 25. Take no usury of him or increase. You shall not give him your money upon usury. Leviticus 25, verses 36 and 37. And unto thy brother you shall not lend upon usury, that the Eternal your God may bless you. In Deuteronomy 23, verse 20. You know, in the early church, any interest on debt was considered usury. So let's take a look and see what interest or usury on debts, which is a violation of the law of God, is doing to America. And keep in mind that when you go down and you sign a contract, you know, to buy something, you know, it's a choice that you make. And if that's what you want to do, you know, well, you know, get after it. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But it would seem like to me that somebody ought to point out to you that there are rules, that there's cause and effect, that there is an end outcome that comes from these decisions that you make. And perhaps if you knew what the end outcome was, for instance, when you go to Flo's whorehouse, you know, the end outcome is sexually transmitted disease. It's called STDs today. I used to call it VD when I was a kid, but now it's called an STD. 25% of America's teenage children, you know, high school children, 25% have a sexually transmitted disease. Did you know that? That's a cause and effect relationship. It comes from sexual permissiveness. You know, don't let me get in the way of your sexual activity, boys and girls, but you know, there's a cause and effect relationship that comes from your activities, and you ought to be aware of that. Now, back in 1977, here's a little blurb that came out of the Lynchburg newspaper called The National Debt. The National Debt. Now, this is 1977. Let's count that up. 1977 to 87, 97, and we're now pushing 2007. So about 30 years ago, here's where your national debt was. Here's the story. In 1901, the national debt of the United States was less than $1 billion, spelled with a B. See, it was in the millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, but it wasn't a billion yet. It stayed at less than $1 billion until we got into World War I. Then it jumped up to $25 billion. So World War I added 25 times the amount of debt to our national debt. Then between 1918, the end of World War I, and 1941, the beginning of World War II, on the eve of World War II, the national debt just about doubled from $25 to $49 billion. So you add on to the Depression years and all of the New Deal welfare programs that got into play there, and we added another $25 billion to the national debt. Between 1942 and 1952, in that 10-year period, the debt went from $72 billion to $265 billion. And in 1962, it was $303 billion. 8 years later, in 1970, it was $383 billion. So you can see there that from 1900 to about 1970, in a 70-year period, it went from $1 billion to $383 billion. All right, between 1971 and 76, in that five-year period, it rose from $409 billion to $631 billion. And the estimated debt at the end of this year, now that's 1977, is $727 billion. The next year, it is expected to top $800 billion, having nearly doubled in the past 8 years. Now, if the present trend continues, and there is no evidence that it will not continue, we can expect the national debt to nearly double again within the next 6 to 8 years, and by then the interest on the debt alone should be in the $400 billion a year range. Eventually, the government will own nothing, the people will own nothing, and the banks will own everything. It's called the miracle of compounding. I've pointed that out a time or two here on the program. When you take a penny and you double it 32 times, it totals $40 million. Now, the people that deal with money, you know, bankers and people that deal with interest, you know, the guy that's going to give you that 30-year mortgage on your house for 5% interest, he's fully familiar with inflation. He's fully familiar with the compounding effect of 5%. He knows what he's doing. He's not doing that because he's some dummy. Now, the guy that is signing the mortgage, you know, Joe Sixpack out here driving truck and fixing wires and, you know, the plumbers, the carpenters, and the electricians, I'm not sure that all of those boys are able to do the arithmetic. 5% doesn't sound like too much interest, especially when you're paying 15, 20, 25% interest on your credit card. You know, 5% interest sounds like a hell of a bargain, doesn't it? But the miracle of compounding comes into play. And as you can see here with our national debt. Now, in 1900, the national debt was less than $1 billion, and today it is nearly $8 trillion. It's just a tad stone's throw away from $8 trillion. It'll be $8 trillion by the end of the year, as I speak here in 2005. Now, a trillion is 1,000 billion, so you've gone from 1 to 8,000 billion in 100 years. Have you ever thought of that? Now, boys and girls, can you multiply over the next 100 years? You know, just take a look at 8 trillion. Now, multiply that times 8,000. Wouldn't that be 8,000 times 8 trillion? Well, let's just test that. If you had 8,000, that's 8,000 billion. So if you had 8,000 times 8 trillion times 8 trillion, wouldn't that be 64 trillion? This would be 640,000 trillion, wouldn't it? 8 times 8,000. 8 times 8,000. That's 64,000 trillion. $64,000. Well, I don't know how much money that is. Hell, I have a hard time counting up to 500 or 1,000, but I want to tell you that that's a bundle of money. And then there's interest to pay on that. And you see, did you notice here in the article it tells you that the debt doubled about every 8 years? It doubles. Okay, if you take $1,000 and you double that, that's 2,000. Double that, that's 4,000. Double that, that's 8,000, and so on. Okay. Well, how many doubling periods do you need for this money to double? And the answer is, if it's doubling every 8 years, well, then the cycle at 8 years means that about every decade, your debt is doubling. Hey, listen, you know, you do that a few times, and pretty soon it goes right off the charts. That's what we call a Ponzi scheme. It gets to the point where mathematically it's irreversible and the problem can't be solved. And that's where America in our debt problem today is. And the government is expanding the money creation because we have this inflationary problem. And you see, we have to continually inflate the money supply, because if we don't, it stagnates and we slip backwards, and that's called depression. We don't want that, do we? And then ultimately, if you keep going forward, you get to the point where you can no longer service your debt. And that's where America is today. We can no longer service our debts. Well, it isn't quite that bad yet. We're still making all of our payments, but we're getting to the point where it's just nip and tuck. You see, right now, Americans are borrowing $2 billion a day to make your payments. Yeah, just to make your payments. Now you got to borrow $2 billion a day. Well, you know, if your creditors ever shut you off and say, "Well, gee, I'm not going to loan you $2 billion tomorrow," you won't be able to make your payments. Now that's coming. One of these days, that's going to happen. And when it happens, well, then that's the end of the road. Now that doesn't mean that that's the end of life. That means that that's the end of the party. The end of the party. And then drunk and hungover, you know, for a couple of days is the penalty that we're going to pay for that. So economically or nationally, nations don't die, nations don't quit just because, you know, take a look at the Germans in 1923. They inflated their currency, their money system, until it went belly up. But, you know, Germans are still living there in Germany today. But in 1924, the people who owned the property in 1924 were different people than owned the property in 1922. That's the bottom line. So you take a look at all the toys that you have, boys and girls, and when this thing turns turtle, somebody else is going to own all those toys. And that's not going to be very pleasant. So I just thought I'd share that with you. Now, let's suppose that you've got a few toys and you want to hang on to those toys. There's a way to do that, but you got to get in here to be the first. You know, if you're 5th, 9th, or 15th on the list over here, you're probably not going to get paid. But if you can get up here in the front end and get off into one of the lifeboats before the ship sinks, you'd probably do a little better. So there's the story on your national debt. Now, there's three types of conquest. Three types of conquest. You know, if you want to conquer a nation like Iraq, you know, there's three ways to do that. If you want to conquer the United States, you want to conquer the Roman Empire, the Egyptian Empire, the Aztecs, or somebody else, three ways to conquer another country or another empire. Here's what they are. History reveals nations can be conquered by the use of one or more of three methods. The most common one that we think of is conquest by war. In time, though, this method usually fails because the captives hate the captors and they rise up and drive them out if they can. That's what you see going on in Iraq right now. Much force is needed to maintain control, making it very expensive for the conquering nation. Now, we've spent, I think the number is around $200 billion on Iraq, the conquest of Iraq so far, and we're headed toward $300 billion. Through 2005. So, yeah, I'd say that was pretty expensive. Now, let's see. The Iraqis over there have 115 billion barrels of oil. Now, that's the target. And we want to conquer Iraq and take their oil. So, you got 115. And let's divide that. That's 115 billion barrels of oil. We've spent $300 billion so far. So we've spent about, $3 a barrel to conquer them and to take that oil away from them so far. Now, that's pretty inexpensive. Oil selling for $50 a barrel. And, say we have to spend another $300 billion to get their oil away from them, that'd be $6 a barrel, you know, in that neighborhood, $5, $6, $7 a barrel. And at $50 a barrel oil, that's pretty reasonable. So conquest, but you notice that we're not nearly as excited about conquering North Korea as we are about conquering Iraq, are we? And that's because you'd spend another $300 billion on North Korea and you wouldn't get any oil. It'd be kind of a waste of your money. Now, the second method is by religion, where men are convinced that they must give their captors part of their earnings as obedience to God. Such a captivity is vulnerable to philosophical exposure or by overthrow by armed force, since religion, by its very nature, lacks military force to regain control. Once its captives become disillusioned, then, you know, people say, well, gee, I think we ought to make a change. Now, down in South America, you can see this happening. The Catholic Church 30, 40 years ago had about 95% of all the people in South America in their ranks. Today, it's only 70%. About 30% of the people down in South America have converted to some other religion because Catholicism has not solved their problems. And so they've become disillusioned with Catholicism, and they're making a change from nearly 100% Catholic to 70% Catholic. That's a 30% inroad by Protestants down there in just the last, 30, 40 years. Pretty significant. All right, the third method can be called economic conquest. It takes place when nations are placed under tribute without the use of visible force or coercion, so that the victims do not realize that they have been conquered. Tribute is collected from them in the form of legal debts and taxes, and the people believe that they're paying it for their own good, for the good of others, or to protect all from some enemy. Their captors become their benefactors and their protectors. Although this is the slowest method to impose, it is often quite long-lasting, because the captives do not see any military force arrayed against them. Their religion is left more or less intact. They have freedom to speak and to travel, and they participate in elections. So without realizing it, they've been conquered, and the instruments of their own society are used to transfer their wealth to their captors and to make the conquest complete. Now, in 1900, the average American worker paid very few taxes, and he had very little or no debt. Last year, payments on debts and taxes took more than half of what he earned. Now, remember, this book was written in 1977. So back in 1977, boys and girls, nearly 30 years ago, you people were being taxed at the rate of 50%. It hasn't gotten any better since then. I just wanted to point out to you that this conquest by economics has taken place past tense. It's already an established fact, and you're living in that conquered nation today, and you're one of the participants in it, and you're one of the beneficiaries. You're being protected from terrorists and terrorism by your government. And your government takes $37 billion and spends it on Homeland Security for your benefit to protect you from these terrorists. Isn't that just real special? Thought you'd like that. Now, in 1900, the average American worker was paying very few taxes and had very little debt. But now you're paying half of everything you create and produce. Now, that's in 1977. Today, it's more like 75%. Now, 25, 30 years later, it's moved from 50 to 75. Now, here's the numbers. Let's suppose that you're in the capital gains business. Well, the capital gain tax has been reduced by President Bush, so that's a good point. But the last time I checked, it was 28% before it was lowered, and I think now it's around 5 to 7%. Your inheritance tax, which is around 53%. Gasoline tax, 17%. Excise tax is 10%. And luxury tax is 6%. Now, the Bush administration has been lowering your tax rates. And that's good. That's good. And they need to be lowered, because once the taxes get to be confiscatory, people get upset in a hurry. So what you do is you reduce the taxes, that stimulates the economy. So they're doing two things. One, they're stimulating the economy with tax cuts, and then they're increasing the money supply. That makes money easier for you to borrow and to do something with, which stimulates the economy again. Now, this has been going on now since 1933. It's called Keynesian economics. And it's a part and parcel with the fifth plank and the second plank, and the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto. Second plank calls for a heavy progressive income tax. Fifth plank calls for a central bank. And the eighth plank calls for the nationalization or the creation of an industrial army. We call that Social Security today. So with those three planks in place, the captivity of America and all of the Americans has become complete. And that's just real special. That's why I pointed out to you that I thought I'd get out of the banking system some years back. And like my great-granddaddy, now he didn't have a bank account. He didn't do business with bankers. And I've said before, and I'll say it again, if you never do business with a thief, you'll probably never be stolen from. Now, your income tax, sales tax, Social Security tax, property tax, inflation tax, and hidden taxes. Have you ever added those up? Well, try this. Take 42, 6, 16, 6, 3, and 7, and add that up and see what you come up with. So whether you are a businessman paying capital gains, inheritance tax, and gasoline taxes, and excise taxes, and luxury taxes, or you're a working stiff and you're paying income tax, sales tax, Social Security tax, property tax, inflation tax, and hidden taxes. Let's see, 42 and 6 is 48, 54, 60, 70, 80%. Now, your income tax used to be 42%, but God bless George Bush, he lowered that for you. Now, sales tax in Missouri is still 6%. Social Security tax is still 16%. Property taxes are around 6%. Your inflation tax, that's the inflation's running at around 3%. That's what they tell us. The truth is it's more like 12, but they lie to us a lot. And then you got hidden taxes. Well, inflation is one of the hidden taxes, but the more typical hidden tax is when you go into the Holiday Inn and you buy a room, or you pay for your room. And then your local taxes that are put onto that Holiday, and you're paying that in the price of your room. Those taxes that they assess to the Holiday Inn, Holiday Inn doesn't pay those taxes, they pass them on in the room rent to you. Now, those are called hidden taxes. Isn't that real neat? All right. Now, this process, three types of conquest. Foreign armies have not come into America and taken over. And they have not conquered you through religion, although that's a step in that direction. They've conquered you economically. They imposed upon you the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in 1933. Took your gold away from you so you couldn't pay your debts at law. Put you in discharge instead of payment. And until I was about, an adult, 20 years old, Americans didn't use checks very much. Yeah, that's right. The average Joe Sixpack didn't have a checking account. It wasn't until the, 1955 to 60 era that we started getting checks. And that's about the era when we got credit cards. And so they expanded checks and credit cards down to us little guys. Rich people always had them, but, us little guys down here, we didn't have that. But from about 1960 on, all of us little guys now have checks and credit cards, and now we're in debt just like all the big guys are. Well, hang on. Let's give you a caveat here, and we'll be right back with more on Billions for the Bankers and Debts for the People, written by Sheldon Emery back in 1977. Let's take a look and see how things have changed, if they have. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in the scope of the world over the Internet, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on a compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. One last item over here for our stations and affiliates. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management or staff of the network, or of this local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct, 417-273-4967, to get your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about billions for the bankers and debts for the people. Now, the real story of the money control over America can be summed up like this. The study on money is not copyrighted, and it may be reproduced in whole or in part for the purpose of helping the American people. So Sheldon Emery, when he wrote this, said, you know, we got a problem here, and I think I'd like to share this with other people. I met Emery back in the early 1980s. He's a pretty nice guy. He's dead now, but he is a pretty nice guy. I always liked him, and went down to his church two or three times and presented seminars and little talks, and we'd chit-chat back and forth, and he was quite a bit older than I was at the time. So I always, when I went down there to Arizona, I always took a special interest in the Sheldon Emery lectures, because he's a little older than I was and had gray hair, and he could smarten me up. So let's see if we can't smarten up here a little bit. Now, Americans are living in what is called the richest nation on earth, and we seem always to be short of money. Wives are working in unprecedented numbers. Husbands hope for overtime hours to earn more or take part-time jobs evenings and weekends. Children look for odd jobs for spending money. The family debt climbs higher, and psychologists say one of the biggest causes of family quarrels and family divorces, breakups, is arguments over money. Much of this trouble can be traced to our present debt money credit system. Too few Americans realize why Christian statesmen wrote into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. It's Article 1 of our U.S. Constitution. Now, why did they do this? Well, they did this, as we're going to show you, in hopes that it would prevent this love of money from destroying the republic that they had just founded. And we'll see how subversion of Article 1 has brought on us the evil of which God's Word has warned. Now, money is man's only creation. Economists use the term create when speaking of the process by which money comes into existence. Now, creation means making something that did not exist before. Lumbermen make boards from trees. Workers build houses from lumber. And factories manufacture automobiles from metal, glass, and other materials. But in all of these activities, they did not create. They only changed existing materials into a more usable and therefore more valuable form. This is not so with money. Here and here alone is where man actually creates something out of nothing. A piece of paper of little value is printed so that it is worth a piece of lumber. With different figures on that piece of paper, it can buy the automobile or even the house. Its value has been created in the truest sense and in the truest meaning of the word. And money creating is very profitable. As is seen by the above illustration, money is very cheap to make, and whoever does the creating or the making of this money in a nation can make a tremendous profit. Now, builders work hard to make a profit of 5% above their cost to build a house. Automakers sell their cars for 5% above the cost of manufacture, and it's considered a good business. But money manufacturers have no limit on their profits, since a few cents will print a $1 bill or a $5, $10, $20, $50, $100, or $10,000 bill. It doesn't cost any more to print a $10,000 bill than a dollar bill. So that profit is part of our story. But first, let's consider another unique characteristic of this thing that we call money, the love of which is called the root of all evil in the Bible. Now, an adequate money supply is needed, and an adequate supply of money is indispensable to civilized society. We could forego many other things, but without money, industry would grind to a halt. Farms would become only self-sustaining units, and surplus food would disappear. Jobs requiring the work of more than one man or one family would remain undone. Shipping and large movements of goods would cease. Hungry people would plunder and kill to remain alive, and all government except family or tribe would cease to function. You say that's an overstatement? Well, not at all. You see, money is the blood of civilized society, the means of all commercial trade except simple barter. It is the measure and the instrument by which one product is sold and another purchased. Remove money, or even reduce the supply of money below that which is necessary to carry on current levels of trade, and the results become catastrophic in short order. For an example, we need only look at America's Depression period of the 1930s. Now, the bankers brought on that depression of the 1930s. In 1930, America did not lack industrial capacity, fertile farmland, skilled and willing workers, or industrious farm families. America had an extensive and highly efficient transportation system in railroads, road networks, and inland and ocean waterways. Communications between regions and localities were the best in the world, utilizing telephone, teletype, radio, and a well-operated government mail system. And no war had ravaged the cities or the countryside. And no pestilence weakened the population or stalked the land. Nor had famine stalked the United States of America in the 1930s. The United States of America in 1930 lacked only one thing, and that was an adequate supply of money to carry on trade and commerce. Now, in the early 1930s, bankers, the only source of new money and credit, deliberately refused loans to industries, stores, and farms. Payments on existing loans were required, however, and money rapidly disappeared from circulation. Goods were available to be purchased, jobs waiting to be done, but the lack of money brought the nation to a standstill. By this simple ploy, America was put in a depression, and the bankers took possession of hundreds of thousands of farms, homes, and business properties. The people were told times are hard and money is in short supply. Not understanding the system, they were very cruelly robbed of their earnings, their savings, and of their property. Money for peace? No. Money for war? Yes. There seems to be no shortage of money for war, but there's always a shortage of money for peace. Well, World War II ended the Depression, and the same bankers who in the early 1930s had no loans for peacetime houses, food, and clothing, suddenly they had unlimited billions of dollars to lend to the United States government to build army barracks and K-rations and uniforms. A nation that in 1934 couldn't produce food for sale suddenly could produce bombs to send free to Germany and Japan. So with the sudden increase in money, people were hired. Farms sold their produce. Factories went to two shifts. Mines reopened, and the Great Depression was over. After all, World War II was on. And some politicians were blamed for it, and others took credit for ending it. The truth of the matter is that the lack of money caused by the bankers brought on the Depression, and adequate money during World War II ended that Depression. That's how simple that is. Now, the people were never told that this simple truth, and in this article, we're going to endeavor to show you these same bankers who control our money and credit have used their control to plunder America and place us in bondage. Now, the power to coin and regulate money. When we can see the disastrous results of an artificially created shortage of money, we can better understand why it was that our founding fathers, who understood both money and the laws of God, insisted on placing the power to create money and the power to control money was to be left in only the hands of the federal Congress. They believed that all citizens should share in the profits of its creation, and therefore the national government must be the only creator of our money supply. And they further believed that all citizens of whatever state or territory or station in life would benefit by an adequate and stable currency, and therefore the national government must only be, by law, the only controller of the value of the money. So Congress would create it, and Congress would control the value of it. So since the federal Congress was the only legislative body subject to all of the citizens at the ballot box, it was in their hands, the only safe depository of so much profit and so much power. They wrote it out in the simple but all-inclusive citation in our Constitution that says, Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. Now, what has happened is that this franchise, this power to coin money and regulate the value thereof, has been transferred from Congress to a private banking cartel called the Federal Reserve Bank. So how the people lost control of the Federal Reserve is the next item that we should look at. So instead of the constitutional method of creating our money and putting it into circulation, we now have an entirely unconstitutional system. Now, this has resulted in almost disastrous conditions, as we shall see. Since our money was handled both legally and illegally before 1913, we shall consider only the years following 1913, since from that year on, all of our money has been created and issued by an illegal method that will eventually destroy the United States if it is not changed, which is not very likely. Now, prior to 1913, America was a very prosperous, powerful, and growing nation, at peace with its neighbors and the envy of the world. But in December of 1913, Congress, with many members away for the Christmas holidays, passed what has since become known as the Federal Reserve Act. For the full story of how this infamous legislation was forced through our Congress, you should read Conquest or Consent by W.B. Vinard. That's Conquest or Consent, W.B. Vinard. So, omitting the burdensome details, it simply authorized the establishment of a Federal Reserve Corporation with a board of directors. It's called the Federal Reserve Board to run it, and then the United States was divided into 12 Federal Reserve districts. Congress created this institution. Now, this simple but terrible law completely removed from Congress the power to create money or to have any control over its creation and value, and it gave that function to this private Federal Reserve Corporation. This was done with appropriate fanfare and propaganda that this would remove money from politics. They didn't say, and therefore from the people's control, and to prevent boom and bust from hurting our citizens. The people were not told then, and most still do not know today, that the Federal Reserve Corporation is a private corporation just like General Motors or Ford. It's controlled by bankers, and therefore is operated for the financial gain of the bankers and the banking industry over the people, rather than for the good of the people. And the word federal was used only to deceive the people. There's nothing governmental about the Federal Reserve Board or the Federal Reserve System. Now, more disastrous than Pearl Harbor has this 1913 act been to America. And since that day of infamy in 1913, more disastrous to us than Pearl Harbor, the small group of privileged people who lend us our money have accrued to themselves all of the profits of printing our money. And they've made more than that. Since 1913, they have created tens of billions of dollars in money and credit, which is their own personal property. They then lend that money to our government and to you and I, the people, and they do so at interest. And that's why the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And the rich get richer and the poor get poorer had to become the secret policy of our national government. An example of the process of creation and its conversion to people's debt will aid in our understanding of this process that we call the creation of money. They simply print it. This private banking corporation prints money and then we borrow it and pay them interest. In other words, it's a license to counterfeit. It's a license that's granted by Congress to the Federal Reserve so that they can print our money and regulate and control the value of it. And they determine through Alan Greenspan, as he comes before Congress every now and again and testifies and tells them, here's what we're going to do. We're going to expand the money supply, or here's what we're going to do next. We're going to contract the money supply, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. So the banks print it, and we borrow it, and then pay interest. So let's start with the need for money. Now, the federal government, having spent more than it has taken from its citizens and taxes, needs, for the sake of our illustration, to borrow some money. So they borrow $1 billion. Since it does not have the money, and Congress has given away its authority to create money, the government must then go to the creators, the bankers, that's this private banking corporation, for the $1 billion that they want to borrow. But the Federal Reserve, which is a private corporation, doesn't just give its money away. They're in business to make profit. So the bankers are willing to deliver the $1 billion in money or credit to the federal government in exchange for the government's agreement to pay it back with interest. So Congress authorizes the Treasury Department to print $1 billion in U.S. bonds, which are then delivered to the Federal Reserve bankers, who in turn create $1 billion and lend it to the government, and then we pay interest. Now let's look at that a little more pragmatically. Let's suppose that you came to me and you said, hey, George, I would like to borrow some money from you. So I say, well, okay. And I take some gold that I have saved over a period of time and I give you my gold. And I say, well, I'm going to charge you 5% interest for the use of my money, my gold. So I loan you 100 ounces of gold, and at the end of the period, you give me back 105 ounces. Now, that's the way the normal system of lending used to work in this country. Well, the Federal Reserve comes along, and they now have the power to create and to lend money. They create the value of this money. That's why our money today is worth about 3.5 cents compared to 1930. They have inflated the money supply. All right, so let's suppose we go to the bank and we say, well, we'd like to borrow the same amount of money. Let's just say that it's $10,000 and we want to buy a car. Well, the man at the bank hands you a note. This is a piece of paper on 8.5 by 11, and at the bottom you sign it. It's called a promissory note. It says, I promise to pay $10,000 plus interest for this period of time. Now, where does the banker get the $10,000? Okay, now watch him create it. He's going to create a checking account with $10,000 of credit in that account and put your name on it. Now, you have $10,000 worth of checks that you can write. See how simple that is? Now, you can go out and buy that car or big screen TV or whatever you want. Buy inventory for your store. That's the creation of money. Now, under the biblical system, God put so much gold and so much silver in the earth's crust. And there's 17 times more silver in the earth's crust than there is gold. So under that system, if we want more money in circulation, somebody has to go into the mining business and go dig a hole in the ground and mine that gold out. So he puts in so many hours of labor to get that gold. Then he takes that gold and he goes and spends it on the automobile, or he goes out and spends it on something. That's the way money used to get into circulation. It was done by labor. Today it's just done by fiat. And of course, if I were to give you this little perk, and I said to you, look, it isn't right that you should have to go out and work and sweat and dig holes in the ground and mine gold to make your living. I'm going to give you a franchise. I'm Congress, and I'm going to give you a franchise. You have the power, you have the corporate franchise to create money. So you just go out and create all the money you want. All right? So you go out and you get an engraver, and he starts engraving plates, and you pay him some money, and he gives you these $100 plates, and you start printing $100 bills, and you take these $100 bills out and you buy cars and everything. Wouldn't you like to have that kind of a franchise? I think that's a hell of a deal. I'd love it. I wish Congress would give me the franchise to go out and create money. Then I could do even something more spectacular with it. We would outlaw gold and silver. Leave only my money supply, only my money creation as the means of putting money into circulation. And I would create these $100 bills and lend them to you at 5% interest. Now, isn't that just a heck of a neat deal? And how long is that going to go on? Well, so far it's been going on for about, pushing on 90 years. 90 years. And this corporation has now bought up everything in America. Can you point to anything in America that's not owned by the Federal Reserve Bank? Why don't you think about that? And we'll take this up here again next time, tomorrow night. You just think about how much of America is owned by the Federal Reserve and how much of America is owned by you. How many acres of land do you own? How many automobiles do you own? How many ounces of gold do you have, or cattle, or sheep, or what is it that you own? I think if you'll take a look at it, aren't you paying property tax on your house? And if you don't pay the property tax, won't they take it away from you? And don't you pay an auto registration on your car? And aren't you making payments on your car? And if you don't make the payments and register your car, won't they take it away from you? I mean, you just think about what it is that you have an equitable interest in and what it is that you actually own that's your personal private property that nobody else has any claim on. Mull that one over and we'll take it up right there next time. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.